This is Peace Talks, making peace with ourselves since 9/11.
If you want peace, if you want to be happy, then develop a heart that is ready for anything.
A discussion exploring the quest for inner peace in troubled times.
We're all faced with these ongoing threats of more terrorist attacks. And I notice myself, I worry a lot, particularly when I'm traveling.
How does one settle a mind made anxious by terrorism or by modern life?
There's always inner conflict. There's a peace side and there's a war side. Now, how do we balance them?
Can inner peace lead to a more peaceful world?
And if our hearts are full of generosity and love and wisdom, we will project into our institutions those qualities, and they will have an enormous effect in the world.
Stay tuned for Peace Talks, making peace with ourselves since 9/11.
I'm Suzanne Kreider. In the days following September 11, 2001, many of us experienced a heightened state of anxiety and inner turmoil that upset any sense of inner peace we might have previously felt. Even without the intensity of a terrorist attack, don't we all experience fear and uncertainty in our normal daily lives? There's uncertainty about our health, aging, and inevitable death. Or we feel dissatisfied with our work performance, our looks, our possessions. We worry about how best to spend our time, energy, and money. And how often have these inner conflicts led to outer conflicts with family, friends, and coworkers? What can we do about our inner turmoil and how it impacts others? How can we begin to make peace with ourselves? In a moment, we'll discuss our common quest for inner peace and its relationship to a more peaceful world. First, producer Paul Ingalls asked some people to reflect on their personal pursuit of inner peace.
The way for me to channel it, is that what you're asking, or how I handle it? Look at the mountain or go to the mountain. Sit in the backyard, just look at it, contemplate, think, meditate. And that's the way I handle it.
I take a ride in my car and listen to music that will soothe me and make me start thinking calmly. And trying to get my inner peace back to where it was before.
When I'm mad at myself for doing something, I try to relax, go to my room and think about it, and then I come out and I feel a lot better.
For me personally, I've always focused on family, but I think it's brought it home even more that that's what's really important, and to just spend as much time with my family as I can. I had cancer 8 years ago, and I've really tried to focus on living in the here and now. That's not, you know, totally ignoring the future, but just really trying to focus on what I have now. And that's a way that I can calm myself down when I get anxious about other things, which would include September 11th.
For me, the best thing is just readings from the Bible and just try to get a good understanding of what the Bible's trying to tell me. And I kind of pray about it and just spend some time just looking at my life, where I want to be, where I'm at, why is it that I have the conflict, and how do I move to my target of where I want to be.
As a Navajo person, that's a Diné person, there's always inner conflict. There's a peace side and there's a war side. Sa'an is the protection side, which is dealing with war, and is the peace side, and it's the beauty way. So when I'm agitated and when there's conflict, I consciously recognize both of those things and realize that that is who we are. Now, how do we balance it? How do I balance it?
Can you tell me when you feel conflicted or upset, what you do to try to calm yourself and find inner peace?
Mm-mm.
Okay.
I know what I do, but that's private. Thank you.
Okay, inner peace for me comes from living in the moment and finding a way to quiet my mind so that the thoughts I have are still, and I'm not dealing in the past and the future, but just in the present. And that always brings me a sense of inner peace. It doesn't come naturally for me. I have to remember it over and over and over again.
I mean, there is an enormous battle raging in my head right now. And I don't feel that I'm doing anything particularly constructive about it right now. What have I done in the past? Trying various things, methods, paths, techniques. What they offer is a way to live in a world that doesn't make any sense, basically. Is it enough to be good and true and loving to the people immediately around me? Is that enough? I don't know.
Welcome to Peace Talks, Making Peace with Ourselves Since 9/11. I'm Suzanne Kreider, speaking to you from an auditorium on the campus of the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. An audience is gathered here to explore the mystery of finding inner peace in troubled times. In preparing for our program, we asked folks about their personal pursuit of inner peace. We heard many people describe a daily struggle to find balance between what one person called the war side and the peace side in each of us. Others shared their personal approaches to inner peace, such as connecting with nature, music, or prayer. The purpose of this program is to define inner peace and to explore a variety of ways to develop it. We're going to open this discussion up to our audience, as well as hear from some therapists and counselors who help people manage their inner turmoil. To begin, we're going to talk with someone who addresses these issues daily. He is Eric Kolvig, a student and teacher of contemplative practices for over 25 years. Eric received a doctorate in English from Yale University, and today he helps people to develop inner calm by leading meditation retreats in the Buddhist Vipassana tradition all around our country. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you. Thanks, Suzanne.
Later, we're going to talk about your response to 9/11. You've told me it was a very difficult time for you. But first, we're all faced with these ongoing threats of more terrorist attacks. And I notice myself, I worry a lot, particularly when I'm traveling. So what helps you the most to manage this kind of worry and to maintain inner calm?
One of my teachers once said to me, if you want peace, if you want to be happy, then develop a heart that is ready for anything. Easy to say, but I think for me in part, developing inner peace in challenging times, keeping our heart open in hell, which sometimes we're called to do, means really engaging fear, really engaging the anxiety itself immediately.
Engaging the anxiety. When I get anxiety, boy, I'm sweating, my heart is pounding.
Right.
How do I engage that?
Well, you know, it's a Franklin Roosevelt, when he first became president, his very first words to this country are the ones that are most memorable. We have nothing to fear but fear itself. This was in the middle of the Great Depression. A lot of people were suffering. In order to get past fear, to work our way through fear, we have to engage it directly to see what it is. Fear is always about something in the future. It's never about something that's happening in the moment. The future doesn't exist. Fear is a projection of something that may or may not happen. And when you see that, if you can see you're simply projecting something into the future, you don't have to believe it. You can say, I don't need to believe this. And to come back to whatever your present situation, no matter how challenging it is, by reducing the fear, your present situation is much more workable.
So we're basically making it up. We're making up these thoughts about it, but are we making up the body's response?
I think the body follows the mind, actually. Not always. You know, if you have a rattlesnake coiled right in front of you, the body will respond and the mind will respond, and that's a kind of useful fear to protect ourselves. But to distinguish between a reasonable kind of fear, where we need to back off from a charging bull, and the kind of fear where we're projecting a kind of future that doesn't exist. Just one little example is years ago I was doing some deep therapeutic work, and I was working with some severe trauma that I had as a child. And as a result of doing that work, terror actually came up, and not just in the therapeutic situation. So I was driving to work one day, and I was experiencing terror. My hair was standing straight up, you know, that there were these waves of energy going through my body. Very intense experience. My mind happened to be strong at that moment, and so I knew it was just fear, and I was able to hold it. So as I just held fear there and just kept driving, I got to work, and a coworker greeted me and said, "How are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm experiencing terror right now, but otherwise I'm fine." And it was true. In that moment, I didn't have to believe the terror. And so it was possible to feel all the physiological reactions and all of the contraction in the mind and say, okay, this is just fear.
So eventually it falls away.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually we're going to get back to this ideal steady state that we call inner peace.
Mm-hmm.
What is inner peace?
Inner peace is an absence of inner conflict. It's an absence of anxiety. It's a quality of, how could I describe it, of being of confidence, of calm, of a kind of happiness, and a feeling of simplicity. It's nice, actually, inner peace.
So how do you help people through meditation to develop confidence and calm?
You know, it's basically what we do in our spiritual practice is to develop two qualities, an open heart and a clear mind. An open heart, basically a heart full of love, is a heart full of acceptance. It's willing to turn toward things without resistance. And you can see that how that can be an antidote to anxiety or fear, which is a resistance in the heart. And a clear mind is simply seeing things for what they are. For example, if I know absolutely that I will die, that death is certain, and that the time of my death is uncertain, and if I come to accept that fact through the clarity of mind of simply seeing this is a truth, the fear of death begins to fall away. I begin to simply not to be that concerned about dying. So open heart, clear mind.
So let's start with open heart. What's a technique or a strategy that we can use to develop that?
Well, there's an actual meditation practice for developing loving kindness. And when we talk about loving kindness, this is not, in this culture, our concept of love is pretty devalued. This is not about Hallmark. It's not about sentimentality. It's really about a great power. Mohandas Gandhi said that if just one person developed love, the highest form of love, that love could neutralize the hate of millions. It's that powerful. And we could use, actually, with our present global situation, we could use a few thousand Gandhis right now. And there are actually ways of cultivating the heart, as it were, so that it is more and more open and accepting no matter what the situation. By basically developing a sense of connection and benevolence and friendship toward all beings, not only humans, but all living beings.
So how do I do that?
Well, would you like to do a tiny little meditation in this moment?
Sure.
So if you would, just close your eyes. And let's start by sending love to yourself. And then if you would just silently repeat these words, "May I be happy. May I be safe from all danger and harm. May I be healthy in body and mind. May I live with ease and well-being. May I be free." And then if you would just extend that feeling beyond yourself to all beings everywhere, without any discrimination, may all beings be happy. So that's what we do. We repeat these phrases over and over again. And it works. It's very powerful. This particular meditation practice was developed specifically as an antidote to fear. And so if someone is feeling fear or anxiety, this practice, if we take it to depth, will just dissolve. And it will also dissolve other forms of aversion, like grief, like hatred, like anger. So it's very useful practice, and it's a practice that I personally did after September 11th, many, many hours of it over the months after that time. And it does dissolve fear. It works.
So how about if our listeners can't remember all those phrases? What then?
It would be enough to wish for themselves and to wish for every person they met, especially the people who cut right in front of them in traffic, you know, and do something dangerous. Especially the people that they find difficult in their lives, is simply to have the wish, may you be happy. That's enough.
This is Peace Talks, and we're talking with meditation teacher Eric Kolvig about making peace with ourselves. Eric, we've talked about the first piece, which you said is having an open heart. How about clear mind? What's a specific technique or tool to develop a clear mind?
Well, let's suppose that you're not feeling inner peace. Let's suppose that you're feeling just the opposite, that you're feeling a great deal of anxiety and worry and concern. My guess is that most of us experience this at some time or other in our lives. To use clear mind is basically to know what is happening as it happens. And so what you would do is to bring awareness to your experience. So if you're feeling a lot of anxiety, you will have certain sensations in your body that are associated with that experience. If you bring your attention to your body and actually feel those sensations, simply by being with it in that precise way, it helps to dissolve it. And then to notice also what's happening in your mind. If we're feeling a lot of anxiety, it's very often anxiety about something. And so there's a big story in the mind, a big thought story. And to notice that and to realize I don't have to run this story. I can hit the stop button.
So basically what you're saying is I just watch my thoughts. I can kind of watch them to death. Is that how it works?
No, it's not so much that. But this is something I've been doing myself, actually, for the last few months. It's been so useful. I just decided my own particular tapes, which have been running my entire life, unwholesome ones. My particular tape is, I am alone, I have always been alone, I will always be alone, which comes from the trauma of my childhood, is to say, gee, that's not true. I don't ever have to intentionally think that again. And so I stay vigilant. And when that thought and other unwholesome thoughts come, I just hit the stop button. I don't have to believe that. I don't have to think that. It's very simple. As soon as you stop believing it, it falls away.
Okay. So we've talked about inner peace. Now let's talk about the interaction of our inner experience with other people. And this is where it gets tricky. I want to tell you a story about a postal clerk who we have this strange relationship where we really push each other's buttons. And I'll be standing in line and actually trying something like the loving kindness that you mentioned. I have this intention to be very kind to this person. But when I get up to the counter, anything I do pushes this guy's buttons, even if it's to help him. Like I'll put the package on the scale and he'll get really angry and say, put the package on the counter. And then it just goes into this contagion effect where we're just punching each other's buttons. So talk about how we can maintain inner peace when we're with people who are angry.
One of the real keys to our happiness, to our inner peace or inner happiness, is to understand that it's not what happens to us that causes our unhappiness or our suffering. It's how we respond to what is happening. We just don't have control over other people. We don't have control over many of our situations, that we get old, we get sick, we die. The people we love most, we lose often. We don't have control over our circumstances, but what we can learn to do is to respond more and more skillfully. So you might push his buttons. you don't necessarily have to let him push your buttons. And to really notice, what is it about this interaction that's disturbing me? You want him to be nice. He's not nice. So is it possible for you to maintain a stance of friendship and warmth and support for him even when he's not being nice to you?
That's difficult.
It is. That's why the one person developing a highest form of love can neutralize the hate of millions. It's learning skillful response.
Next, we'll open our discussion up to our audience here at the University of New Mexico and talk more with our guest, Eric Kolvig. A bit later, Paul Ingles talks with four professional therapists who help people cope with their inner conflicts. I'm Suzanne Kreider, and you're listening to Peace Talks, Making Peace with Ourselves Since 9/11. This is Peace Talks, Making Peace with Ourselves Since 9/11. I'm Suzanne Kreider, along with Eric Kolvig, who has studied and taught contemplative practices for many years. Let's shift to back to this topic of 9/11. And would you be willing to share briefly what your experience was after that tragedy?
I was supposed to fly on September 11th, the morning of September 11th, and so I was trapped, or I was stranded, I should say, far from home. I thought I was handling it okay. About a week and a half after 9/11, I had gotten home after a few days. I found myself going into post-traumatic stress disorder because I had a very acute trauma as a child. Both of my siblings didn't survive what happened. So I'm the one survivor of the children. And so I think what happened for many people after September 11th is that those of us who have a history of trauma found that the public or social trauma that we were all going through basically converged with the private trauma. And so I went into post-traumatic stress disorder, and it was very difficult. Actually, I went for several weeks. And what I did and managed to pull myself through it was, one, I got a lot of psychotherapeutic help, and two, I did a lot of loving-kindness practice. And this loving-kindness practice basically brings great stability and peace and happiness and love to the heart. I was so extraordinarily harmed, physically, sexually, emotionally. I was so harmed as a child. It has taken me a while to learn that I can give absolute unconditional love to myself, and the wholeness that comes out of that is extraordinary. You know, one of the thoughts may come, if you were badly harmed as a child, is that you're worthless. If that thought comes, you simply turn to it and say, I choose not to believe that. I am absolutely worthy. You know, and I will love myself into healing. It can happen. I'm not out of the woods yet. I still get post-traumatic stress, but I would either have been dead or institutionalized years and years ago if it weren't for psychotherapy and meditative practices. And I'm at least functional now.
We're going to take some comments and questions now from our audience here at the University of New Mexico. Hi, your name?
Mary. The other day I was driving and I saw a bumper sticker that said, God is American. And I realized there was a reaction in me that brought up some anger. And I'm curious about how you would respond to the relationship between anger and fear and that very strong impulse to want to do something and how we can interrupt that, because it seems to me it's endless.
Right. A very good question. Basically, fear underlies just about all of the unwholesome qualities of consciousness, like anger, like grief, like rage, like hatred. And so if you're feeling anger, you can find fear underneath it always. Essentially, what we're doing with anger is we're trying to protect ourselves because of fear. What we're doing with greed is trying to gratify ourselves out of fear. And so to drop back and to feel the fear. But I just wonder if I might also engage the bumper sticker, God is American. And one of the points that I didn't make earlier that feels especially important to me is that to me the deepest source of inner peace is to experience that reality which is boundless. I don't know quite how to describe it, but just one little example. Recently, I have gone back and reread for the umpteenth time Viktor Frankl's wonderful book, Man's Search for Meaning. It's his account of being in 4 concentration camps, Auschwitz, Dachau, and others. And the beautiful account that he has there of people who manage to keep their humanity, to keep their inner peace, even in inconceivable circumstances. At the very end, after he's liberated, he goes out for a walk from the camp, the last camp that he was in, and he's out in this beautiful spring landscape, farming landscape. And he said at one point, he finds himself on his knees, and he forgets himself and he forgets his world, and there's only one sentence going through his mind, and it's from the Psalms. And that sentence is, I called out to the Lord from my narrow prison, and he answered me in the freedom of space. There is a freedom of space. There is something we can call it God, we can call it nirvana, we can call it the boundless, we can call it whatever we want to call it, our true being. But if we experience that and know that that's what we are, it's an extraordinary source of inner peace, because we know what dies and what doesn't. So much of the fear falls away. And so to say that God is American, I think, is really to miss the point. If we all experienced God directly for ourselves, so much of the conflict of the world would disappear.
Thank you.
Go ahead, please.
It seems like everyone's always trying to push past and work through emotions of rage and anger. My question to you is, and a question that I pose to myself almost on a day-to-day basis when I'm doing a number of things, but why is it then that we have anger, rage, terror? Do those work? Are those for our instincts? I mean, are those like warning systems? And also, it seems that you guys were talking about a balance, but it's almost like those kinds of emotions are like the bad in us, like the dark side. And then, you know, trying to heal through that is like using the force. But what I want to know is, if we can't stay angry and if we can't stay enraged about something, what are they there for? And what do these emotions do for us?
I'd just like to respond to that from the perspective of my own spiritual tradition. And essentially what the founder of that tradition said is, abandon what is unwholesome and cultivate what is wholesome. And he said that the wholesome qualities of consciousness, like love and compassion and calm and peace and happiness, are intrinsic to the mind. They belong there. You can't get rid of them on the deepest level. And that the unwholesome qualities that come, like hatred and anger and fear and envy, for example, that they're only visitors to the mind. They're not intrinsic. And so the wholesome qualities actually are more powerful than the unwholesome ones. And essentially the unwholesome ones come because of ignorance on the deepest level because we don't understand our true relationship to things. And so it's not seeing them, not seeing the unwholesome qualities as bad or the dark force or evil in any way. It's just seeing that they're a result of a mistake. And it's actually possible. So we don't see them as the enemy. And in fact, the way that we heal from them is not to try to actually get rid of them, but to turn toward them and to embrace them.
Yes, your comment?
Hi, my name's Diane. And I don't know, Eric, if you could just sort of profile our country a little bit, our country's karma, I guess. You mentioned earlier that there's a lot of unworthiness and self-judgment in this country, and we know there's a lot of addictive behaviors and violence. And so what do you see in this country? What do you see some of the reasons for those feelings of unworthiness or what I just mentioned?
I'd like to say something positive about this country. Gary Snyder, the great poet and philosopher, has said that the mercy of the East, that is Asia, is individual insight into the selfless nature of things, that is the experience of enlightenment. The mercy of the West is social justice, and he says we need both. I think that Western civilization has contributed the concept of social justice to the world. We just haven't lived up to it yet. And we've contributed the concept of democracy to the world, of empowering people. Those concepts are still there. They're embedded in our Constitution, in the Declaration of Independence. They're embedded in the great speech of Abraham Lincoln, of the people, for the people, by the people, for the people. This is what our government could be. And so it's just a question, in a sense, of our living up to our ideals. And from the perspective of my spiritual tradition, all suffering comes essentially from three things. It comes from greed, it comes from hatred, and it comes from delusion. And to reduce those qualities in the world and to strengthen the opposites, non-greed, which is generosity, non-hatred, which is love and compassion, and non-delusion, which is wisdom, that would be a good thing for us to do as a people, because what we do is that we collectively project into institutions the qualities of our hearts. And if our hearts are full of greed, hatred, and delusion, we will come up with institutions that are full of greed, hatred, and delusion. And they will wreak havoc in the world. And if our hearts are full of generosity and love and wisdom, we will project into our institutions those qualities, and they will have an enormous effect in the world.
There seems to be quite a breakdown right now.
There is a breakdown right now, but I actually feel pretty optimistic because I think the wholesome qualities of consciousness are getting very strong. It's still an undercurrent. So thank you. It's a wonderful question.
You're listening to Peace Talks, Making Peace with Ourselves Since 9/11. Meditation teacher Eric Kolvig is our guest, and we'll continue our discussion in a moment. But first, in the days following September 11th, psychiatrists, psychologists, and therapists reported seeing shifts in their clients. Our producer, Paul Ingalls, talked with several of these professionals about various methods used to help people make peace with themselves in troubled times.
Krista Barrett is a social worker with the Albuquerque Schools and a therapist whose practice focuses on getting children and some adults to express and heal their inner conflicts through play. Her office is lined with shelves of colorful figurines and toys that her clients pull down to play with in sand trays and boxes. Play that took on a different quality in the days following 9/11.
They were building blocks, and they were flying airplanes into the blocks and talking about the effect on that. And so they were replaying, literally, the news, which they always do. That's what children do. We do it as adults, too, but I think children do it even more graphically and through play. And they're constantly trying to make sense and rework what it is that they've seen and how they can function with this knowledge that this has happened. Children, a lot of times they don't have the language that adults have to be able to describe their experience. And so play is a way that they can work through what they have been through very quickly. They can show what happened, and then they can experiment with it, and they change it a little bit to help them through it. And it's an amazing process, really, to watch. I worked with a child who experienced a death of a brother, and it was too painful for her to talk about, but she was able to play in the dollhouse, a little girl and her brother, and re-experience some of the positive memories that she had with her brother.
Immediately after 9/11 was a very interesting period in terms of my patient's response.
Dr. Jan Fawcett is professor of psychiatry at the University of New Mexico.
If my patient had a background of fairly high level of function, like a moderate to mild depression, but they didn't need to be hospitalized, they weren't, you know, severely ill, they got very upset by this. They would call me and say they were getting more and more depressed. And I would tell them, how many hours have you been spending in front of the television watching the news? All the time. And I said, turn it off. That was the therapeutic maneuver, turn it off. Because the repetition over and over and over again. But they got very, very distressed about their lives. What does it mean? You know, what's going to happen? What's the future? All kinds of anxious anticipation. It's more and more the more they listen and watch television. The more severely ill patients who are just, their lives are just suffering, they can't function, it didn't mean a damn thing. It was interesting how little it meant to them, really. They can't even project themselves out of themselves enough to absorb the shock and significance of this event.
Dr. Fawcett's work has focused on these severely depressed and sometimes suicidal patients. He relies on traditional behavioral and cognitive talk therapies and, for the extreme cases, the use of antidepressants.
Usually they need medication. Not medication alone, but they need medication. And the question is really, what's the best approach with the medication? What's going to work? And what's the best choice for that patient? Whereas other patients with less severe disorder, there are many more options and many more opinions that one can get. And I think people should get different opinions and make their choice about what helps them.
And for some, says Dr. Fawcett, all that may be needed is a shift in perspective.
9/11 was a horrible thing. But you know what? Instead of being frightened about things, I think people should say, God, you know, I've got some wonderful people around me. I've got wonderful beauty around me. I've got, you know, I better appreciate it. It's a miracle what I've got.
I mean, life in the society that we live today can be very traumatic.
Raina Luna is a counselor and massage therapist. While she's worked with people who've experienced both severe traumas of war and natural disasters, she warns others not to minimalize the effect of more common sources of stress and trauma.
I mean, is it a self-inflicted form of violence to lead such a busy life that we don't have time to sit down and experience moments of peace? Is it a violent act not to be able to take the time to spend time with your friends and family? Acknowledging our fragmentation and acknowledging our the awareness of the fact that we all have a history of trauma is a big one, the biggest obstacle. After that, I think there's some common things that have to be there. You have to have commitment, willingness, and intent, because it takes work. We live in a society that offers quick fixes and instant gratification, fast foods or pharmaceutical drugs that fix things overnight. And so I think, again, it gets back to the idea of doing the work.
usually in the second half of life, a person begins to sit up and say, well, something's wrong. I've been doing this for years and years. I'm not happy. What do I want to do? Now, if that question can be asked honestly, then there's a chance the person can finally begin to live their life. And it's not about money. It's about their soul.
Therapist Stephen Wong practices dream analysis to help his clients find peace.
Our work is to help a person see what is unconscious in them. And that is through not only talking about their own lives on a personal level, but also looking into their dreams, because the dreams give us the information of what is unconscious. So if a person can first become aware of what is unconscious, what they are projecting out into the world, then there's a chance of resolution. There's a chance that the person can come to a point where there's a moment of peace and the deepening, because really this work is about soul. It's the evolution, development of the soul.
Thanks to producer Paul Ingalls for that segment. After a short break, we'll be joined by one of the therapists featured in that piece, Raina Luna, and we'll continue our program. You're listening to Peace Talks, Making Peace with Ourselves Since 9/11. I'm Suzanne Kreider.
There are more resources and information about obtaining copies of this program at peacetalksradio.com.
This is Peace Talks, Making Peace with Ourselves Since 9/11. My name is Suzanne Kreider. We're coming to you from an auditorium on the campus of the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. An audience is gathered to discuss the pursuit of inner peace in troubled times. We've been talking with Eric Kolvig, a meditation teacher who has studied and taught contemplative practices for over 25 years. Eric's going to stay with us, and we'll be taking some more comments and questions from our audience. But first, we're joined by counselor and massage therapist Raina Luna. We just heard from Raina before the break in our piece by Paul Ingalls. Raina works not only with clients here in New Mexico, she also travels to other countries to assist victims of war and natural disasters, and has recently returned from El Salvador. Welcome, Raina.
Thank you, Suzanne.
So in that recorded piece we just heard, you talked about the need to take time, to slow down, to do the inner work, to develop that peace. You know, many of us use our commitments that we have to our family, our work, recreation, as an excuse for just not getting help or not taking this time to slow down. What are some suggestions you can make for how people can slow down and take time to do that work?
Well, I think that early morning time is very important time. And taking a few minutes just to sit quietly, even if it's 5 minutes. I mean, that's difficult. 5 minutes is difficult for some people at first. You can suggest that they begin with 1 or 2 minutes each morning, sitting quietly. They can do it before they go to bed at night. They can take their lunch time and sit quietly for a few minutes. There are a number of activities people can utilize. Yoga is an incredible way to get started on this kind of quiet time, or developing the awareness of your body and where you carry stress. You can do things like breathing exercises
that perhaps they can do while they're driving in the car to and from work or taking the children to and from school. You can use a lot of the suggestions that Eric spoke to earlier.
I want some help from you in defining some terms that I think come from the therapy world. Could you just define for us the difference between anxiety and post-traumatic stress disorder?
Well, they are very similar in symptomatology. However, with post-traumatic stress disorder, the symptoms are much more exaggerated and a little bit more complex and more enduring. There are basically three categories of symptoms with post-traumatic stress disorder: intrusive re-experiencing of the event. It's like reliving the event. And with that, you might have recurring nightmares, hallucinations about the trauma, intrusive emotions. The second category is avoidance, where the individual attempts to avoid places or things that remind them of the trauma or the event, numbing out of the emotions to avoid painful or overwhelming feelings. That's also known as dissociation. And the third category is arousal. They might have the startled response, where they're easily startled, very jumpy, irritability, sleep disturbances, difficulty in concentrating. They might have panic attacks that are accompanied by shortness of breath or chest pain. So you can have some of this along with anxiety also. But if it doesn't go away, then I would suggest that one look into the possibility of having PTSD.
Then my other question is about treatment, because in the piece that we heard by Paul Ingalls, Stephen Wong talked about dream analysis, Krista talked about Santre. There are so many different techniques, somatic experience, different talk therapies, EMDR. Presuming that a person could afford one of these, how do they know which one to use or which ones to use?
I think it depends a great deal on what one is more comfortable with and what approach one might be more comfortable with. So I think you have to do a little investigation and research to find out what these approaches are like and see what fits for you.
And how about for folks who are underinsured or uninsured? What options do they have?
That's another difficult one, because there isn't really much available for people who are underinsured or uninsured. I would strongly recommend meditation or yoga and begin there, because there's a great deal to be gained. And I'm a true believer in naturalistic approaches that allow you to work on healing from within and maybe might not cost a great deal.
So our topic for this program is inner peace. And we do plan in the future to do a show just on diversity issues. But I would like to touch on how diversity relates to inner peace, and to ask you about your personal experience as a Latina/mestiza. How does your personal experience impact your inner peace?
I have an incredible role model in my life, which is my mother, who has come up through life with huge struggles and lots of problems to overcome. Coming up within a culture that there were attempts to wipe it out in this part of the country, in New Mexico specifically, those attempts have been really successful to a great degree. And so there is always that challenge for me as a Latina mestiza to maintain peace in the light of all of this.
How do you do that?
I shout at God a lot of the time and say, God, you're asking too much of me. I have
been an avid student of A Course in Miracles. And The Course in Miracles almost sounds a lot like what Eric was talking about in terms of themes of fear and love. And so I work from that position of really confronting the fear, really being with that fear, really understanding that that fear does not have to take hold of me, and also seeking to find and see with other eyes the divine in everyone that I come in contact with.
Therapist Raina Luna and meditation teacher Eric Kolvig are our guests today on Peace Talks. Let's connect again with our audience here at the University of New Mexico. Let's take some questions or comments for Raina.
Yes, I know you went to Latin America recently, and I'd like to know if you could describe what it was like to visit countries that have experienced huge trauma. And what were you doing there? Did you were doing massage, or were you talking or counseling people?
Yes, to all of that. I was part of a multidisciplinary trauma healing team. And so we did do a little bit of Santre, art therapy, play therapy, body work. We sometimes just listened to people tell their stories. We were asked to go to El Salvador, which, as many of you know, has suffered first through a civil war that lasted 10 years, and then earthquakes on the back of that, and then floods. And currently they're suffering through a famine that has been brought about by drought and then hit immediately with the monsoons. I could hardly believe what it is that these people have gone through and still continue to have the most incredibly generous spirits and open hearts of most any people I have come across in my life. So I'm not so sure what it is that creates this in people who have had so much suffering. But they are so grateful for every little thing that you offer to them. They need everything. They need everything in terms of material things that you and I take for granted. They're living in cardboard houses, and there are no jobs, and there is no food. One of the things that in the final evaluation that we did, one of the social workers that we work with and are in touch with there said that many people come to their country in terms of Christian aid and all of the various charitable organizations. And she said, we are so grateful to them, and they build housing structures which are desperately needed. And they said, we appreciate it all so much. And they said, but no one has come and touched our people, really touched our people. And that speaks to me to that incredible importance of healing touch between human beings.
We have just a few minutes left, and I wanted to ask each of you to recommend a few books or websites or other resources that people might consult for more information. Raina, do you have some suggestions?
There are several websites for trauma work. But the first one is SIDRAN, SIDRAN.org. Another one is trauma-pages.com. And Peter Levine's work is under traumahealing.com, all one word. There is a particular website of Bruce Perry's work, which is child trauma, capital C, capital T, .org. And davidbaldwin.org. These are all really, really wonderful trauma websites that I think will be helpful for people.
Great, thanks. Eric, suggestions?
Well, I actually can't recommend any websites because I'm one of the five remaining people in America who doesn't use the internet. But I could recommend a number of books. I mentioned Viktor Frankl. It's F-R-A-N-K-L, Man's Search for Meaning, an account of the concentration camps during the Nazi era. It's an extraordinary book in terms of the resiliency and the radiance of the human spirit. Some other books that I have found useful, a book by Joseph Goldstein and Jack Kornfield called Seeking the Heart of Wisdom, one by Stephen Levine, A Gradual Awakening. A book that I have found very useful recently is the whole movement of nonviolent communication, of finding ways to communicate that are not harmful and not blaming. You know, we're not going to come to inner peace until we stop blaming ourselves and blaming each other. And so Marshall Rosenberg's book, Nonviolent Communication, A Language of Compassion, is the subtitle. So those are a few, and once you start, you just keep following the trail.
Thank you for those recommendations. We're going to list those along with some other resources and some materials and also some excerpts from this program on our website, which is peacetalksradio.com. That's peacetalksradio, typed as one word, .com.
I'd like to just make one other point, if I may, a point that feels important, and that is to see that when great challenges come to our lives, like September 11th, or personal trauma, severe personal trauma, or the loss of someone that we love, when those enormous challenges come to our lives, we can either see them as a terrible affliction or we can see them as an extraordinary opportunity. My experience has been that when people are comfortable in their lives, we tend to be complacent, and when we're happy enough to be living on a fairly superficial level. And when something really difficult happens for us, I'm, in a sense, glad that I had acute trauma as a child because it put me on a path of deepening and awakening. I think that it could be an opportunity, the trauma that we've experienced on September 11th, it might shift us out of our complacency as a people. That Viktor Frankl says about the concentration camps, he says, the concentration camp ripped open the human soul and exposed its depths. And it's out of that depth, then, that very deep change can happen, a transformation can happen. And so, in a sense, I'm glad that fate has dealt me hard blows, because if one can see each time that we're profoundly challenged to say, what can I learn from this? How can I deepen? How can I change? Then nothing is an affliction any longer.
Thanks very much. I'd like to thank meditation teacher Eric Kolvig and counselor Reina Luna for being our guests on this program. And thanks to our audience here at the University of New Mexico for their participation. I'm Suzanne Kreider. Thanks for listening.
Support for this program came from Wild Oats Community Market at 2103 Carlisle Northeast in Albuquerque, KUNM, and the Science and Technology Park at the University of New Mexico. Production assistance from Rachel Cobb, Katrina Lucas, and David Herman. Recording engineer was Tristan Klum. Peace Talks, Making Peace with Ourselves Since 9/11, is part of Public Radio's special coverage, Understanding America After 9/11. This program was produced by Paul Ingalls at Cedar Creek Studios.
There are more resources and information about obtaining copies of this program at peacetalksradio.com. Additional material from the question and answer session.
Hi, my name's Ron. My question, I guess, was around the clarity of thought issue, and you're talking about our intentional thoughts that we do and then all these other non-healthy thoughts that we tend to, and sometimes I refer to it as looping, we get these things into our head and for some reason can't seem to quite clear them. And you mentioned pushing the stop button, and I know that sounds a lot easier than it is, and I'm sure through a lot of practice you probably get better at it. But do you have any other suggestions for that? My stop button is very quick to come back on again. You know, I'll find myself going, why am I thinking about this? Just stop. And it it stops for a few seconds, and then it comes right back again.
There are basically two things. One is it requires quite a bit of patience to work with the deep, deep tape loops. You know, I mentioned one that has been going on since I was an infant, actually. And so these are pretty hardwired into the system. And so just to be patient, they're going to keep coming back because they're deeply conditioned to come back. So just to be patient with it, each time you interrupt it, my suggestion is not to see it as those thoughts as an enemy, because that's just creating more internal conflict. So one way to look at it is to think of it as a Girl Scout selling cookies. You know, she's come to your door and she's offering you these cookies to buy, and you don't want to buy the cookies. And you want to be able to say to her, no thanks, but without insulting her. So even the most violent and terrible thoughts, you can approach them in the same way you would turning away a Girl Scout selling cookies. No thanks, I don't need that today. If you simply face those thoughts enough times, you begin to decondition them. So and then one other thing too is that if you notice that thoughts are really obsessive, that they keep coming back over and over and over again, it means that they're being driven by some strong emotions. And if it's possible to let go of the storyline of the thought and to drop down and to experience the emotions that are driving them, like anger or resentment or anxiety, fear, hatred, rage, whatever, and to experience the emotion, so you're coming from the secondary level down to the primary level, which is driving the thought process, then you're able to decondition that more quickly. And I'd suggest feeling the sensations that are associated with the emotions in your body when you do that.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
I'm Geraldine, and I also suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder and had a similar triggering after 9/11, which surprised me because I didn't feel that it had affected me. I'm wondering what you see as the healing aspect of the meditative practices and that you're talking about.
It's a very important question. Just to share a little bit my own experience is that there was so much damage from trauma that I was basically told by the psychiatric community, we can't help you. There has been too much neurological change. We can maybe manage this with drugs. And basically I said to them, I don't believe that. So I think the most important healing thing is the faith that actually this can be changed. And so I just basically had the intention, if it takes me a million lifetimes, I will heal this heart from its suffering. You know, I really devoted my life to it. And finding there are now many, many different modes for healing available in this society that didn't exist 25 years ago for those of us who are survivors of trauma. So one is the intention, to have the intention to heal. That, I think, is a positive healing force. And then of all the other forms of healing, I think that love is bigger than trauma. Love is bigger than death.
Hi, I'm Judith. Eric, I have a lot of conflict. I've had it ever since 9/11 with feeling the pain in this country, but also a consciousness or a worry that we're so worried about our pain and we're not aware of what's going on in Afghanistan and the pain of that we're causing, the pain that we're a part of. And I get frustrated at what I feel sometimes is a preoccupation with our inner peace when I feel like we should be worried a little bit more about other people's struggle. Can you comment on that?
Absolutely. I think it's a beautiful question. I think we're so much reacting to situations rather than looking for deeper causes. My sense is that if we really want to eliminate terrorism in this world, terrorism toward us and terrorism toward others, we need to eliminate poverty in the world and injustice. we need to make a commitment to do that. And in order to eliminate poverty, we also have to be willing to reduce affluence. And what does that mean in terms of our choices as Americans? So I agree with you. There's enormous suffering in the world, and it has generated reaction. And if we really want to have a secure world, if we want to be secure as Americans, we have to make sure that everyone is secure, that they have enough on the material level in their lives. And so I agree with you absolutely. I think that, in fact, it never works, actually, for us for a nation to believe that they can find safety and security by making war on the world. So it would be very helpful for us to start to focus on much of the suffering in the world and to try to see what are the causes of that suffering and to see is there some way that we can start to eliminate the causes. That's where we will really come to peace. So thank you.
Thank you.
Go ahead, please.
I really can't relate to the psyche of the nation as a whole. I can only relate to my own experience. And while I have love for many people, many things, for most of my life, I've tried to overcome feelings of fear, guilt, rage, stemming from childhood abuse. While I succeeded in channeling many of these feelings into positive venues, the remnants of those feelings do persist somewhere deep inside. And my question would be, with those scars remaining, is it better to try to forget that past, to reinvent that past, or at some point do you have to work through some acceptance?
We had an interesting discussion a few days ago about just that and living in the past and what we do with our history. And the past can only hurt us to the degree that we are unable to forgive it. And as Eric said, the future really isn't there. I mean, it isn't real. It isn't. And so I think that through the process of forgiveness, we can begin to release the past. And that is truly a process, and it truly requires being able to go there where the fears are, where the hurt is, where the scars are, and begin to forgive ourselves as well as those that we believe have harmed us and hurt us. So from my perspective, it is a process of working through forgiveness.
We have another question from the audience.
Yes, my name's Don. I was interested in your discussion of how trauma is cumulative and that we may receive it from other generations and that we may pass on the effects of our own trauma to the next generation. Can you suggest a way to intentionally break this cycle?
Well, it seems that the word intentional is probably the most powerful word I can come up with in response to your question, and that is that we have the intention to do so. And I think with the intention to do so and the commitment to do so, doors are open to us and ways are open to us. The type of therapy appears before us that we just happen to need. But it requires intent to break that cycle. What we know about the nervous system and the neurobiology of trauma now is much more extensive than we've ever known before, and how it affects the learning of children, attachment issues for children. And so it really behooves us to begin working on the resolution and healing of our trauma, because it changes the brain chemistry and alters the nervous system. And I think you would be amazed as we begin to heal trauma and settle back into a calmer nervous system. People around us change, our work situations change, and it spreads energetically in the most amazing way.
I'm assuming that it is important to talk about or share the trauma or the fact that we have experienced it, and perhaps with the next generation so that they may know also.
I'm a great believer in telling our stories as a therapeutic tool. I mean, I'm a great believer. New Zealand Aborigines use that as a therapeutic tool in their communities, and it works fabulously. So I think that's a very powerful way of doing so. What I would like to say is that for those of you who aren't great talkers or do not wish to talk about it, there are therapies, again, out there just for you. And you can work from the felt sense of the body and re-educate the body so that it learns to heal itself, which is the body's natural ability.
Let me interrupt, Raina. What are the titles or names of those kinds of body-based therapies?
Well, somatic experiencing is one of them. That's Peter Levine's work. EMDR, which stands for eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, which is really a psychotherapeutic approach combined with talk therapy, but you can really minimize the talk therapy in that. There are all kinds of energetic body work that can be done. Numerous, and it seems like they're developing new ones all the time.
David, do you have a question? Great. Let's take one more question.
My comment is to your comment earlier about to establish peace around the world, we must first recognize the suffering and causes that cause so much suffering around the world. That seems in itself to me a lifelong pursuit. What are some ways as the average Joe and also an American citizen to actually start acting as a peace activist and to actually start doing something about all the suffering around the world in a way that when I leave this meeting tonight, I just don't go back to my everyday life and I do actually start making a difference. Because I find sometimes that it's too easy to live in a moment where you want to do something, and then 10 minutes later, you're like, okay, let's go to McDonald's. So that's my question.
It's a really good question. My sense is that it doesn't take a very large proportion of people who are willing to act together to bring wholesome change. You know, I think we feel overwhelmed by the institutions. I just read a beautiful statement by Vaclav Havel, who's the president of the Czech Republic. And he talked about being in the years of communism, of being pinned under a boulder, of not being able to move forward with his life or in the people of Czechoslovakia. In a sense, I feel in some ways, this is just my perspective, but we're sort of pinned under a boulder in this country as well. It doesn't take that much for people simply to have the intention, I will bring wholesome change to the world. And you could choose to do it in any. None of us can do it all, but each of us can do a piece. What I would suggest is that you choose the issue that is most important to you, that's closest to your heart, and just say, I will give some of my time and energy to this. You know, so one of the ones I'm thinking about is that the Southwest has been devastated by overgrazing, and so I might get involved with seeing ways of protecting the land where we live here in the southwestern United States from overgrazing. Just one little thing, but one person can make a big difference. Or you might be concerned about children. You know, there's vast sexual abuse of children in this country. You know, to become active in that area. Or you might be concerned about the globalization of the world economy. and the effects of that. Just choose a subject. Say, I'm not going to. I may not be able to give my whole life to it because I have other things to do. But I'll give a piece of my life to it. And you'll just feel how your mind becomes more positive as soon as you feel you don't feel like a victim and helpless anymore, but you're actually doing something. There's a wonderful community of people doing beautiful things, and quite a number of them are right here in this room. And so just connect to them and find a way.